Before lunch, we were talking about Rule 5 and Conditions 2 and 3. And I didn't take perfect note of where we finished up, but I just want to touch on the point about the scenario where I understand there's 77 odd hectares of land that's been identified that may turn into urban development land. That's currently CVP land. You're aware of that evidence?
Yes.
77 or 97, I can't remember the number. Sorry. And in that scenario, I understand that the Hawke NZ position is moving that CVP land from those areas into onto other lands would be crop rotation.
That's correct.
Yes. And so there's a degree of perhaps in contrast to normal crop rotation, if I can call it that, the crop rotation in that particular scenario has a degree of permanence to it, doesn't it? In other words, it's not going back to the area that it's now got houses on.
That's correct, yeah. So it's seen as a form of rotation because it's involved in effect a retirement that's gone into the urban area and therefore a replacement. So the total area hasn't changed.
Yes, that's right. And so it can still be existing CVP, it's just on different land.
That's right.
And in that scenario, looking back to policy 3, jumping there, and those points in policy 3B2, would you agree that the bullet points under point 2 are examples of areas where it would be problematic from a policy and water quality perspective if that relocation occurred with a degree of permanence?
So I haven't put my mind to this in any detail because I've had quite a narrow briefing of looking at enabling rotation across the FM area for the existing. There is a problem with Fong Marino, so I appreciate that that should be ring-fenced out of that. The other matters I would need to put my mind to a bit more.
It's fine, but if the water quality experts were agreed that, and it's reflected now in the policy support, that expansion of CDP into the listed areas there was problematic from a water quality perspective because of the sensitivity of those sub-catchments, then whether it's strictly expansion of CDP or simply rotation with a higher degree of permanence, both really have the same impact and would be subject to the same challenges from a water quality perspective. Would you agree with that?
Not necessarily. What I took from the water quality expert's evidence was that rotation, including movement of vegetable ground land that was being turned to an urban area, so moving that hectare to somewhere else than the FMU, that there would quality modelling, saying that the effect on water quality in the subcatchment of the FMU that that would be illegal would be they haven't given us none of the years, so they're effectively saying that
example that I was talking with you about before lunch, in terms of the grower who's got, say, 50 hectares in one sub-catchment, 50 hectares in another sub-catchment, and their rotation across that area that they've got consent for under this rule. If a grower in that situation wanted to rotate onto other land or more land than their 50 hectares in one particular sub-catchment than they had consent for, would you agree that they could lease some land from another grower in that sub-catchment and grow there in reliance on that other grower's resource consent? And Mr. Ford said yesterday that's pretty much what's happening now, and it's quite straightforward. That was my paraphrase of his answer on that.
That's my understanding, yeah.
Now, just stepping back a little bit to the question of defining existing CDP, the legal submissions for audience here, paragraph 67, said an obvious way to define the baseline would be to make explicit that the maximum hectareage of CDP in any particular sub-catchment may not be exceeded based on the maximum in each sub-catchment in each year. Now, do you recall that statement?
I've certainly read that statement. To be asked a question around it, I might need to read it again and look at the context that it's sitting within.
Yes, have you got a copy of the legal submissions there? I'm happy to have you turn there because there's enough words in it that I don't want to get confused by it. So it's paragraph 67. That's what conditions 2 and 3 do, don't they?
I think the point of difference between what is being said here and 2 and 3 again comes down to that formula of how that sub-catchment area is established. And that's that problem between a maximum year and then within that, a maximum area for any particular year, but then being confined to those sub-catchments that are in there. So that's correct at one level, provided the maximum sub-catchment is able to be adopted, not the sub-catchment hectareage that correlates to the year that is selected.
Understood. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Rustin. Thank you, Ron.
My questions, too. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Ms. Rustin. A number of my questions have been covered already, so I'll just go through a few initial matters with you. you agree that in terms of Te Tiriti Waimana and Plan Change 1 and its objectives, that all four contaminants are important?
Yes.
And the legal submissions for your client address this question of equivalence between different land uses and whether everyone needs to do their part or people should be treated differently. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do.
One aspect of those legal submissions was a question around, well, it depends on who's actually contributing contaminants. In terms of the evidence and the questioning of other witnesses, would you agree, though, that CBP does potentially produce high contributions of nitrogen and potentially other contaminants as well?
So, on what basis do you mean? On a per hectare basis?
Per hectare basis, yes.
Yes, I understand that can potentially be the case, but that context needs to be within the scale of the activity within the subcatchment region. So, yeah.
The scale question that you're talking about, are you talking about at the farm by farm, or are you talking about as far as aggregating the activity across the catchment?
So when you're thinking about on a per hectare basis that it's discharge of contaminants, the effect depends on the breadth of that activity. So that's my alternative to the term scale within the area that you're looking at.
So it's your suggestion then that, in theory, a high-risk activity, if there aren't many of them, that it should be treated differently to something that is widespread but has a lower risk?
No, I don't think that's the formula in thinking about how to achieve the strategy or the objectives of the plan requires such a black and white approach. It's more nuanced than that. So, for example, in the plan, there is the requirement for the farming environment plans and the extensive nature, considering the risks of every site and putting the right mitigations in place to manage that risk. And there is, as shown by Mr. Barber earlier, there is an extensive array of activities in place to try and improve the activities and reduce the effects. So, it's not as black and white in my mind as saying there are high risk nutrient loss and therefore the structure of the plan is just at the moment doesn't recognise that. I think it is. Yeah.
You mentioned Mr. Barber and his evidence in relation to FEPs. You heard him in answer to a question indicate that he would support a requirement for those various risk management tools to be included within PC1. Do you agree with that?
To some degree, with the caveat, as kind of illustrated by what Mr. Bell was showing, is that work evolves and tools evolve. So a tool might be the best we have available today, it might be appropriate to reference in there, but an additional tool could come down the track. So yes, to some degree there may be merit in referencing the tools and the requirements of the FEP while providing the expression to the writer of the FEP and the auditor and accreditation person to consider their use relative to the risks on the site that it's applicable to. So I think the tools are helpful. Whether they need to be black and white identified in the FEP, can be helpful, but it can also be limiting.
And I'll return in a little while to the way that FEPs are required under PC1. And going back to the question of the treatment of different land uses, the submissions for Horticulture New Zealand and some of the questioning of witnesses earlier in the hearing, including Mr. Willis, suggested that CBP is treated more onerously than other activities. Would you agree with that?
Don't we get down to using an unhelpfully simplistic terminology? The one could argue it's more onerous because every operator is requiring a user's consent, and that's not the case for some other land users, so that could be considered more onerous. What's important to me is whether the mechanisms that are being put in place an efficient and effective means of achieving the outcomes we're trying to achieve. So I have some sympathy to the fact that it is more onerous and that everyone needs to get consent.
And so on that, I take it from your answer that you mean you need to look at the various provisions as a whole rather than focusing on one particular aspect.
In terms of managing an activity?
Yes, and the consideration of how onerous or otherwise an activity is treated. That's the bundle of controls as far as activity status plus EPPs, minimum standards, all of those are relevant.
That's correct, yep.
And in terms of the potential for some CBP to be permitted, that would presumably require both minimum standards and some kind of drafting tool as far as the different risks within CBP activities. Would you agree with that?
No, not necessarily. I haven't got my mind to drafting a permitted activity rule for CBP. I understand from the experts that have provided evidence that the Farm Environment Plan goes an enormous way towards meeting what could otherwise have been addressed by minimum standards, but the minimum standards may be a bit of a sledgehammer and in an inefficient way of addressing the potential effects. Whereas an EPP tailors it to the particular risks of the property. And it is, there is potential to write a permitted activity that refers to having an EPP with all the right components in place and not have to. There's nothing that I don't think that a permitted activity in itself leads you to have to put a minimum standard requirement in there. It would obviously, any permitted rule is a drafting page because you've got to meet the conditions to be permitted activity.
And so maybe that's a useful segue then into talking about EPPs. Councillor Dahl, your client, talked about the D1 and D2 and the differing EPP requirements under those schedules. Are you familiar with the differences between them?
Yes, off the top of my head, I recall D1 is about the low intensity farming activities. Yeah.
Council for Horticulture New Zealand had referred to the D2 schedule as being more stringent. Were you here yesterday for Ms. Maher's questioning? And did you hear her explanation of the two schedules with D1 being more specific and less flexible than D2 because it applied to committed activities? Would you agree with that?
Without spending time looking at the schedules again, my inclination is yes, I would agree with that, yeah.
And in terms of the FEPs that might be required for CBP activities, do you have a sense, I've got some questions I can go to, but maybe to cut to the chase, do you have a sense of how long it might be before any of those EPPs might be required?
There's a schedule of time frames and they're not immediate. Yeah.
Would you agree that it's, given the majority of CBP is located within that northern part of the overall catchment, that much of it could be 4 to 5 years after PC1 becomes operative that those EPPs would be required?
So my understanding is that CBP, the majority of them, and I'm sure Michelle Sands, and Sands and her questioning gave a figure for how many of them already have environmental management plans in place under the Zinnick Act. And it was, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but it was substantial and by far the majority. So that process for assessing risk and assigning mitigations exists and is in place now for the majority of CDP growers. So the requirements of the EPPs and under the plan, when they kick in, there's not a wedge in the interim between the two. So, sorry, I lost track of what your question was, but I think what I'm trying to reflect is that it's not a case of nothing being done in the interim. There is an enormous amount which would go a long way to marrying up what is required by the EPPs today. That's right in the plan today.
Do you have a sense of the level of detail that might be contained in these existing EPPs compared to what's required under Plan Change 1?
I haven't sat down and done a diagnostic of the two to see whether they are marrying up, but my understanding from the experts is that it would be a long way towards meeting the requirements that are in the EPP requirements in the plan today.
And in terms of the use of, for example, the EPP risk scorecard, that's Mr. Barber, I understand his evidence was that isn't a mandatory requirement of NZGAP, though, is it?
Look, I'm not an expert on that, sorry. Yeah.
And so, acknowledging that there may be things that various growers are doing at the moment, in terms of what PC1 requires, there for CVP, existing CVP, there is, if it is for a particular subcatchment 5 years before the FEP is required for PC1, there is nothing that PC1 requires in the meantime, is there, for those growers? Sure, and equally though, other land uses have for decades as well been doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Yet for those other land uses, there are minimum standards that do apply straight away.
Yeah.
Want to ask some questions in relation to expansion and just get a sense of at a practical level, as far as a grower who is looking to embark on expansion, how that would be addressed, I guess. In terms of the PC1 requirement for no material increase in risk, when I read it, Rule 8, which is the expansion rule, doesn't itself include any specific reference to offsetting or mitigation. Is that your understanding?
I don't think it does, but I'll just do a quick
skim. If you could, I just want to make sure that as far as the understanding of how the concept of offsetting and mitigation fits in terms of CVP extension.
Yeah, my reflection is that comes in via the policy.
Yes, and so that's...
And policy 3 is referenced to policy 5. Yeah.
Yes, and so policy 3B3, I think, is the relevant policy.
Yes.
And so that refers to no material increase in risk. And then cross refers to policy 5, which provides further detail in terms of offsetting and compensation. Given that CVP expansion would involve a change in land use, just trying to work out from a planning perspective, if you were either advising a client who was going through a resource consent application for this, or equally if you were a report and planner from the council's perspective, how would you, or what would you be looking to as far as evidence justifying or demonstrating no material increase in risk?
So without being a farm systems expert or a water quality expert myself, I'd be looking to the advice of those experts to be able to put the case together to show their relationship. We would bring in the experts, yeah.
One final topic. You would have seen one of the proposals from Mr. Willis was in relation to CVP, where he sought recognition within the provisions of the need to consider how a proposal would fit against drinking water standards.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you agree with him in relation to that?
So when you say agreeing with him, there's his reference to it and his evidence, and then there's the reference to it in the JWS planning. I have reflected on this over the last year while, and I do have my name against agreeing to it, but I think we may have in our haste, or certainly I may have in my haste, overstated it because it reads, so this is on page 14 of the joint witness statement, at the top of that page, that the joint witness statements are planning. At the top of that page, it says that myself, along with some others, including Mr. Willis, had recommended that Article 3B2, a further bullet point be added that states would not contribute to any local exceedance or further exceedance of the New Zealand drinking water standard for nitrate, nitrogen, and groundwater. I reflect on that stronger than what I feel comfortable having my name against, so I apologise that I've agreed to the sentiment and perhaps the words are stronger than what I would prefer. I do think that when considering expansion, the potential effects on the quality of drinking water needs to be considered, but I don't see it needing to be as black and white as what is stated here.
Certainly, and on that, I think Mr. Willis also acknowledged that it's potentially a bit more binary than he had intended as well, but it's your position that it is certainly a matter that should be have regard to in any expansion application.
Yes.
Just on the question of rotation, given that, sort of building on some questions from my friend Mr. Conway in terms of if you're moving from a sub-catchment approach to an EPMU approach, for example, that there are some areas that, or some additional controls that might need to be in the provisions, and so Whangamarino was one example that Mr. Conway took you to. Do you think if you're looking at rotation in that broader sense, which includes relocation, I guess might be a better way of describing some aspects of what Horticulture New Zealand would have rotation. In those contexts, do you consider that consideration of those drinking water standards might still be relevant there as well?
Yes, and my understanding is that that is provided for through the EVP process. I'm confident there's a provision in the EVP that requires the potential effect on drinking water quality to be considered in that risk assessment and mitigation as part of the EVP process. So I'm not convinced it needs to sit as its own condition to the wrong.
Certainly. I think that covers all my questions. Thank you, Ms. Justin.
Thank you.
take you first to the joint statement planning phase, just to get my understanding correct on that. The 1877 hectare table is set out for expansions, and you don't agree with that table being included in the, to limit the expansions subject to issues on scope. Is that my understanding?
No.
Correct?
No.
Alright, if I can take you down to the roll then. So, if we go to question 25, on page 29, rule 3.3.4.8, so, the sub-clause 5 of that rule states that the land for which consent is sought must not be in the front of the lien or and not be in within certain sub-catchments. And then the following experts agree. At the bottom of page 30, the council's rebuttal version deletes the table of sub-catchment area limits. And if we turn over that page, a table of FMU area limits should be included in this rule using the numbers in policy 3B.
You've lost me as to where you're going. Could you
Okay, it's pages 30 to 31.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so what I'm trying to verify is whether the table of area limits that makes up the 1877 hectares should be included in this rule.
Yes, because the bullet point on the bottom of page 13. I apologise if I'm not, but at the bottom of page 30, it lists the following experts agree, and the last bullet is includes myself. The council's rebuttal version deletes the table of sub-catchment areas. The table of FMU on the next page, the table of FMU area limits should be included in this rule using the numbers included in policy 3B3.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
And so that's part of what we've read.
Okay, so is that table in sub-clause 5? Or the table that I referred to you earlier?
So, I think this problem has come about because the JWS was putting in the original version and then acknowledging what was agreed to and disagreed to in terms of changing that. So, I think when we're talking about 5, we're talking about the table on page 30 in blue that lists the sub-catchment numbers as well. You've got FMUs down one side, sub-catchments down the other. Is that the table you're referring to?
Yes. So, is my understanding correct that the table on page 13 that I referred to you before, you no longer...
That is from under West Court and should be in the rule.
Okay, so you still support that thing on the rule?
Yes.
And that would limit expansion?
Yes.
Right, thank you. Sorry for the confusion. Yes. So yesterday, no, that's fine. Thank you for clarifying that. Yesterday, Ms. Holmes was questioned about the extent to which that would increase nitrogen load. And so the evidence, as I understand it, is that the
impact of 1877 hectares of CBP expansion, which would account for population growth, would increase the end load impact of estimated to be 0.5% increase of total contaminant load at the lowest monitoring point.
Yes, that's my correct main recollection of the evidence. Yeah, I just have to open it to confirm this. That's my recollection.
And thank you. And then when she was questioned by Commissioner Hodges, there was a discussion about whether that would just create localised impacts and whether in fact mitigation measures that you would put in place would address those localised impacts anyway.
Can you clarify your question, sorry?
So we have what reported to be a small overall increase in load at the FMU scale. And this is where we get into the offsetting and compensation policy that would be required. But I'm questioning whether that is in fact required, because whether you could deal with that through the mitigation part of the mitigation hierarchy. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I have the effects management hierarchy, yeah.
So do you know, possibly we have different understandings of what Ms. Holmes meant, but did you hear her say that you could impose mitigations at the farm scale phase expansion such that it's questionable whether indeed you would actually have any effects at the catchment level?
Yes, I recall that, and I think with mitigations, as far as I understand it, is what is established through the farm environment plan. So that's right. So the potential effects should be being assessed and being managed through the provisions required through the farm environment plan.
And so you agree with that the hierarchy, with the mitigation hierarchy. Have you turned your mind to whether indeed you might stop at mitigation because you wouldn't be required to be having an increase in load, or you still wish to use the opportunity of an offset for nitrogen?
I think because expansion is on a case-by-case basis, there is a need, I think there is merit in keeping the door open for an applicant to be able to consider and put their case forward around setting a compensation if it's needed, if it's necessary here. As part of the suite in that hierarchy of managing effects. Yeah.
And did you hear both Ms. Holmes and Mr. Easton say that when they considered offsetting and the framework that you would need around that, that relied heavily on table 3.11.2, which was a table that set out what contaminants were at, on what priority in each subcatchment.
And the decisions version, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that's been deleted. There is now not a sufficient framework to manage offsetting given the deletion of that table?
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think that's from coming back to the nuances of the site-specific application and what the context is in the scenario that's in the application. And also it would sit within the information that is expected to come from council around the catchment context information as well. So just the deletion of that table, I think, doesn't lead to taking offsetting and compensation off the table.
Did you hear my questions to Mr. Easton about the amount of work that the Regional Council has to do, and this is in reference to the JWS freshwater, in order to understand what contaminants are of what priority in each sub-catch?
attachment.
Yes, that's very important. Yeah.
And so, would you agree that it's uncertain at present time whether that can be managed without that work in front of us?
In my mind, there's the value of having this activity status that I'm just going to reflect on a question from the judge earlier the last few days, around a very sort of discretionary or restricted discretionary for expansion. I'm comfortable at that either. I can see some efficiency in here and being restricted. The reason I say that is because what I'm trying to say is that the council needs discretion to be able to be making those very considerations around what are priority contaminants in a particular area and what are the effects of the proposed expansion and so on. So that's why you have an RDA or a discretionary entity to enable that discretion to be applied and an assessment of effects and assessment of mitigations to be considered. So in the absence of that information being provided, there is still the opportunity for the applicant to put their team of information forward and establish their case.
Okay, so in doing so, they'll be guided by Policy 5, which is the Oxygen Compensation Policy.
Yeah.
And have you read the evidence of Dr. Corkery?
A long time ago, yes.
So I'll read you a paragraph from her evidence. This is paragraph 71 of bundle 320.0055. I don't believe that the current proposed trading of nutrients enabled by Policy 5 and described by Mr. Travolco would give effect to Tisiri Whaimana. This trading between nutrients would effectively enable the bypassing of the offsetting step, providing a shortcut to compensation, and would not meet the principles that govern aquatic compensation, and she refers there to the NPSFN. And I'll read you a part of the next paragraph as well. Compensation is the least desirable step in the management hierarchy. And so she goes on to say that this is referring to point source discharges, but here we're just dealing with diffuse. If point source discharges result in an increase in a particular nutrient, for example nitrogen, that proposed to reduce another, for example phosphorus, the residual effects from the nitrogen contamination have not been neutralised or offset, and they are compensated for but still need to be tallied as losses and a result of further degradation to the body. Now, I appreciate some of this is regarding freshwater expertise, but in terms of the offsetting and compensation methodology, are you able to comment on that?
Not on the methodology, but also because it is a case-by-case scenario that relates to and is tailored to the proposed activity and the sensitivity of the society, etc. When I thought about Policy 5, and I appreciate some of the concerns that have been raised by others and some of their answers around trying to establish some certainty around how this policy might be implemented, that my concerns are to a large degree alleviated by the Shepotia policy, which is saying that offsetting and compensating provide for it, but it's got the word there that better achieves the objectives of Tertiary Whaimana. And in my mind, that's the test that would need to be met. So I'm not sure that I agree with the evidence that you just read out in saying that offsetting and compensation isn't going to achieve that, because the proviso is a must for that to be able to be adopted or applied. So I take comfort from the fact that those are within that policy and that the test that needs to be met.
Would you agree, though, that without a specific framework, and rather than reliance on high-level words like that, creates a risk of further over allocation under policy 11 of the EPCM.
I don't think that creates a risk. The question may be because it's sufficiently addressed for us. Sorry, I'm not making sure what we're talking about.
No, I
just don't know my brain approaches it. I come back to it. It's a case, it's about leaving the door open where we've acknowledged expansion of CBP is necessary to feed the nation. And so, how do these go about doing that in a way that appropriately manages the effects, achieves the strategy, and delivers upon the requirements of the NPS and the hierarchy documents, etc.? So yes, I think Policy 5 could potentially be strengthened. Does it need strengthening? I'm not convinced of it.
All right. Just on Policy 11, is it your understanding, based on the joint with the statement of freshwater, and they address this at question 28, that the state of water quality allocation in the Waikato catchment is, with regards to each of the four contaminants, is fully or over allocated?
That's what I understand from another document, yeah.
Alright, and so you would agree that is over allocated for the purposes of policy 11 of the NPSFM?
Detailed chart of words and definitions that you need to come through in the NPSFM to establish that. The target attribute states are established in PC1, and so I'm trying to simplify the answer here, that the water quality specialists have indicated through their evidence that because of the extent of improvement in practice that is expected in the subcation from FMU.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm very sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
Yeah, Mr. Roster, but we might get to that in a minute. I just wanted to start with this first question about whether you consider it's over allocated for the purposes of policy 11 of the NPSFM.
So my answer is not necessarily.
Mm-hmm. All right,
sorry.
Thank you. And if I can take you through those words that you may have been referring to, the definition of over-allocation includes, and that's on page 7, photo 1.0078, a resource use exceeds the limit, or if limits have not been set, then EDMU or part of an EDMU is degraded or degrading. And then if we look at the term degrading, it states that any site or sites to which a target attribute state applies is experiencing or likely to experience, as a result of something other than a naturally occurring process, a deterioration trend. Are those the chain of words that you were referring to?
Yeah, a large part of the chain of words.
Yeah. And so what part of that do you not think applies now, if I can ask you that?
So it's about at the time when a consent application is made for expansion, what is the state of the attribute states, the target attribute states being achieved in the first instance, that is factored into the considerations of the under discretionary activity. There is, my understanding is that the use of words here, but the values that are to be achieved are achieved through the target attribute state, provided they're appropriately used. The direction of travel is towards achieving those target attribute states. The potential for a new expansion to detract from the ability of achieving the target attribute states depends on a myriad of things. My understanding is that the extent of improvements that have been made in the practices of existing CVP create space for expansion to occur and step together to move forward with an improvement in water quality potentially. Or not, depending on the case-by-case scenario. I don't think it's as black and white as the gemstone that that I think what is being implied is that at the local level, any further discharge of a particular contaminant should not be able to occur. I don't think it's that black and white.
So you consider that this question and the application of Policy 11 should be worked out on a case-by-case basis under the discretionary applications for consent.
So whether the water quality of the limitation of application would be established by the council, but whether you are impacting or further advancing that over application would be worked out on a case-by-case basis.
Right, and so my question was, can we say now, based on the data that there's fresh water in front of us, that an over allocation currently exists?
I'm not sure if there's a specific question, but my understanding is that yes, that is the case, yeah.
Right. Thank you. Now just finally, I wanted to raise briefly this principle of proportionality. And your legal counsel referred to it as we don't use the sledgehammer to crack a nut. Now, I want to ask you how that fits in with the NPSFM, because to extend the analogy slightly, we have many nuts here, don't we? And when you're managing cumulative effects, you would have heard the phrase death by a thousand cuts. So the principle of proportionality seems to be directly opposed to the way the NPSFM deals with cumulative effects, which is to set a limit rather than identify whether a particular discharge is very small or not. Do you have a comment on that?
I don't. I guess I come back from that kind of practitioner's perspective of writing a rules that makes sense and can be readily implemented and achieve what's needed to be achieved, and from then applying those rules in a day-to-day sense. So this proportionality issue is a little bit irrelevant to me. It is about managing the effects and taking responsibility for achieving good management practice and the right mitigations in place. They're doing the right thing by assessing the risk, tailoring mitigation to the specific risks of the site and the activity, etc. So this having a position on proportionality contribution, and one being bigger than the other, kind of doesn't factor into my plan making. Yeah.
Mm. All right. Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Robson.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. That concludes Hawke's case, and now we'd like to ask the Footscray Vegetable Growers Association give evidence.
Thank you.
And Ms. Ford will be the remaining PVGA witnesses.
Thank you.
I now call Dr. Stuart Davis. Can you please confirm your full name for the court? And you prepared a brief of evidence dated 28th of July 2023. Mm-hmm. And you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and ability?
Yeah.
I've just got a couple of questions for you. We've heard a lot the past few days around crop rotation, fallow periods, pasture phases, that kind of thing. Can you just explain what crop rotation means to you as a grower?
I guess several things. There are crop phases, so rotation generally involves a number of crops. In season B, it often involves a number of vegetable crops, just because it's generally grown on high-class land, and those are the crops that continue to generate the return across the rotation. Having said that, there are other crops, and I should say that those crops are not necessarily always grown by the same grower, so there's quite a lot of land swapping amongst growers. In our case, we grow two regional crops in the region, but we're in a rotation with typically three others, and various cover crops. In the cover crops, those generally crops that are grown in a sort of soil restorative phase, with the idea of achieving organic matter to the soil, sometimes in weed suppression, and to assist with crop health, soil health.
Thank you. On the effects of crop rotation, in your evidence, you've got a diagram on page 8, which, in my ignorance, kind of looks like pickup sticks and not a kid. Can you just explain what all the colourful lines and what that diagram actually means, please?
Sure. It only relates to our vegetable rotation in the Gisborne region, so what we've been doing there, but it's not so much what we're having here. There are pretty much what is about six vegetable crops in the nodes along the bottom, and three cover crops. And in our rotation there, I guess you would typically include wine grapes in a vegetable rotation, but if you're thinking for 10 years, then they are part of a rotation, because we do pull grapes out and then go back to vegetable crop. Across the top are just the species that attract those crops, and it's really to illustrate the sort of complexity of these vegetations. So I haven't counted, there are just such as 60 species across the top there, ranging from rocks on the left to slates and lights on the right. And those are sort of all the interactions on top of that. You know, we could sort of superimpose the nutrient flows that Mr. Barber talked about, and between those surface crops and the crops in the vegetable crops in the location. So it was really just so that these rotations, once you get into that sort of planning detail, are quite complex.
So this is just one component of your decision making for how you rotate?
Yeah. This was actually drawn because we were considering bringing native species into a wetland, and we didn't want to bring, we'd want to see which species we might bring in with those species, and also which beneficial. Two more layers of complexity, if you like.
Thank you. Can you please remain for any questions from the Friends and Court?
Good afternoon. You may remember I asked your council about the process of crop rotation and the decision making. How long in advance is it planned? And is it a bit of a related question? Is it likely to occur? A decision being made and the process included in a short time frame.
There's, I guess, a broad plan that's probably been thought out 2 to 3 years, which could be 4 to 5 crops in advance. There's some flexibility as well. The recent 2 years that we've had, there's been a lot of different changes that have been made because. In a lot of cases, particularly all year round, which is production, we're in a position where we have to supply every week. And if you haven't been able to cultivate a piece of ground because it's rained in a particular area, then you may have to switch cropping somewhere else.
I'm thinking in terms of the consent conditions that are imposed on a grower and needing to identify them. Parcels of land that they can do their operations on, the farm environment management plan that might identify that they're going to rotate to a particular area. Are those going to need to be rewritten quite often because different decisions have been made that haven't been foreshadowed?
I think that depends on the nature of the operation to some extent. What you consider is going to require a change if you're considering that. CDP is one activity, and not the budgeting of individual crops, as Mr. Barber talked about, is quite a bit because of changes in conditions or testing that's been done.
Right at the outset that your company has over 2,500 hectares nationally, Auckland, Waikato, Gisborne and Canterbury. How, in each region, how stable or how does the area that you have in crops, including areas that are planned for rotation, does that remain stable or would your the area of your operations change significantly year by year or over a period of years?
Year by year, relatively stable, but up ups and downs. I think you know, going back 10 years we went in London, where we are now. In fact, we went in this region at all before 2013, but we replaced someone else who was at right. Someone else's level. In the Gisborne region, we've probably reduced the area as a result of moving away from producing squat trees, for example.
Right. And in terms of making those changes, and I think you may have indicated that in the answer you've just given, while you may either acquire land or shed land, you're probably doing it from other growers. Two other growers? Or how often are you bringing land that hasn't previously been used for cropping into production?
Yes, I'm sure sometimes we have, in the Auckland region we have brought a significant block in production in the last few years.
Right. And if you decided you needed extra land reasonably quickly in any given area, how easy would that be for you to acquire rights to or acquire generally?
In some areas, as women have a sort of a seasonal cold, if you like, of one crop land. It's a little different to what we're doing here in terms of, you know, really concentrated vegetable rotation. So easier in those sorts of areas, more difficult in these sort of high cost land and more intensive.
Yeah, so again, land value may well be a factor because if the land is valued more highly, people are keen to hold on to it.
And often it's already developed.
Asking
for the question. I guess part of it too is that these crops, you know, in our case generally require irrigation, so there's infrastructure as well.
I'm sure there are other factors to it. I was just really thinking broadly in terms of this issue of, as the Commissioner raised, the question of planning ahead with your farm environment plans and the extent to which you would regard the areas that you're involved in as being reasonably stable, or the extent to which you are ready to or may have to increase or reduce the areas you're operating on in the relatively short term.
Yeah, so I'm more strategic rather than operating.
Yes, so, and in that sense, when you say strategic, what sort of horizon are you talking about?
It all depends on the situation, but I'd say you wouldn't make a large change without a 3 to 5 year old.
3 to 5 years. Right. Thank you very much. Your excuse.
I now call Mr. Kurt Macon, sorry.
Good afternoon, Mr. Macon. Can you please confirm your full name for the court?
Jared Macon.
And you prepared a brief of evidence dated 28th July 2023?
Yes.
And do you confirm that your evidence is concrete to the best of your knowledge and ability?
Yes.
Just one question. We heard a lot this morning from Sbaba around the SDS project and EMS and all the things that lead into a farm environment plan. How involved is PBGA in those processes and that research?
PBGA is quite heavily involved, as we're quite a conduit to get all this information out to our growers and to run workshops with them.
Thank you. Can you please remain to answer any questions from my friends of the court?
No, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Baker.
Yeah.
Did I pronounce that right?
Yes.
I just had a couple of questions with your evidence. Do you have a copy in front of you?
No, I don't.
Well, you may not need it. We'll see how we go. So I just noted in your evidence that you are currently the president of the Pukekohe Vegetable Growers Association, and you're quite active in promoting environmental management. And in fact, you have been a promoter and a promoter of environmental management for the growers. So therefore you'd be familiar with some of the conversation I had with Mr. Barber this morning. You were here this morning?
Yeah.
Okay. So I just want to just to give you some context. As you well know, the Director General is seeking setbacks for cultivation, so that adjoin water bodies. And so I'm just trying to understand the measures that are currently in place to manage water going off paddocks and that adjoining water bodies. So hence my questions to Mr. Barber this morning around bums and what do you call it, settlement retention ponds. And so I just want to, he mentioned that it was best to ask the growers the questions I had around those. So I just want to put some of those to you. So it might be useful then for you to have a copy of Exhibit 9. Hopefully it's still there somewhere or might be behind you. So I just wanted to just explore really with you the various measures that growers like yourself have in place on your property. And so if you were to go to section 4 of that document, which starts at page 26, I think it was. Yes, 26. You can take that out of the binder if that helps. So there I see is a raised access way, and I'm just as I told the farmers, I'm not a farmer, nor am I a vegetable grower, so I'm just relying really to explore these measures with you. And my understanding is what we're looking at here on page 26 is runoff from a CVP, and so that's one of the settling retention ponds, would you?
It's not really a settling pond or bund. The raised access ways will be generally used if we've got access way to a field and potentially you've got runoff that can come.
Yes.
So the access way to raise stuff doesn't actually, so it actually has an excess catchment.
Right.
So they use in specific cases, depending on the steepness of the farm or the paddock. And generally that comes in. Back in the day, a lot of access ways were just at the lowest point of fields and stuff.
Yes.
So a lot of that got changed once the practices that really project built on really other practices. And obviously a lot of probably don't see too much of this anymore. But the moon film and film and bugs are generally in the lowest point of the field. So that's where the water's.
I see. So this type of situation doesn't rely on a decanting earth farm?
No, not at all. It has some effect on retaining water on property, but not to the degree that you probably that what we have now.
Okay. So then if we were to turn the pages over to the diversion bun, do you employ this type of measure on your properties with CVP? It's on page 28.
Yes, we have some of those on our property.
And how do they work?
Generally, it's we use those on areas where the slopes aren't great, so you're going to get minimal water movement. Yeah.
farm use for this?
They could potentially be abundant at one end, depending on, again, on the undulations of the field.
And so you say it just sits there, so nothing, it just sits there?
Yes, so that'll be cleaned out. So again, if it runs to one end, the bun will then catch it again and have the overflow of the water, the settle, and then the water comes off. This will just catch the store there. Again, it's all about the angles of the fields.
Yeah. So in those situations where the slope is quite great and these types of measures aren't appropriate, what types of measures
are appropriate? So then we would be looking at, like Mr. Barber was referring to, the sediment control
those ponds.
Yes.
Right, okay. In your experience, how do those work?
They work very, very well. Obviously, one of the key factors for the late 90 rainfall events, a lot of topsoil ended up in the rain and the like. So from a growth perspective, that's our asset that we grow on. So we learned a lot from that, but now we know that we need to manage that asset as it's also an object in other areas. But put it back in the fields and deal with it.
Right, and you mentioned that you clean them out?
So that's it, clean out.
How do you do that?
Usually in the sun or in the spring, depending on the weather conditions, because obviously you can imagine if it's wet, it's just a sloppy, muddy mess to sort of move around, so you've got to allow it to dry and be able to move it.
Right, okay. And much maintenance and
Yes, so we're cleaning them out, their maintenance is getting things in contractors to move the soil out of them, and then obviously make sure that the
But I guess the bigger the catchment, the more work combined.
Yes.
And so with the, if you turn the page over to the vegetative buffers, like through the margins, do you employ these types of measures at all on your property?
No, we don't employ those ourselves. Other growers do.
Other growers do.
Yes.
Any growers here today?
I'm not sure
exactly. Yeah. Right. And so, really, I just wanted to look at the bums and the cows, and I think I had two questions for Mr. Barber, and he suggested I ask some of the growers. But in terms of the maintenance of the bums and the capacity of those, how have those worked for you on your property?
They've worked very well, and like Mr. Barber alluded to, there's obviously a formula for the engagement and to help us work out what we need, but that's really the capacity as a whole for each field. But like Andrew mentioned earlier today, there wouldn't have been a button big enough to hold all the water in the settlement, which is just kept coming. So it worked well as long as we've got normal sort of rainfall.
Which we don't.
That's very difficult, yeah. Yeah. So we do the best we can.
Okay, and so I just wanted to take you to one of the other exhibits you should have there, which is in the folder, exhibit 10, Soil Drainage and Management Guide. So it's a question I asked Mr. Barber and suggested I ask the growers. If you were to go over to the third page of that document, firstly the buns or walls, and you might have covered this thing. Number one, it says they must be thoroughly compacted, otherwise they can blow out in the storm events. That's what you mentioned, isn't it?
Yes, the jury would be able to play on them.
So one question was just in the other column there under overflow and spill at number 3, one of the the guidance there in terms of maintenance is to ensure runoff discharges won't cause erosion. What types of methods do you employ to ensure runoff discharges won't cause erosion?
Do you remember erosion at what point in the farm or
joining the water body.
Yeah, so we're joining the water body direction of the spillway. So there's a third fund that's running over the so we have a spillway that runs over into the local drain or what.
Right, and those same spillways that have high rain events don't work.
We actually have what we call a snorkel system where the snorkels will come out of the ground yay high, and the spillway will be higher than the snorkels. So the water, once it settles, the water will run through the snorkels and out to the drain, mm-hmm. and the spillway will be there if there's a massive flood.
Right.
So.
Okay. Well, those are all the questions I have for you, Mr.
Paragraph 14. You talk about a parameter that PDGA has engaged with, Ngāti Tata and Ngāti Tamaho, etc. Do you recall that?
Yes.
It hasn't been attached to your evidence. Is it publicly available, or is that still some confidentiality? Well, not that I've seen anyway.
I'm not sure. I
can't
answer this. Sorry. I think it's.
I'm not sure if it's publicly allowed to be raised in that
valley.
That's federal and Brindleball Commons. Okay, thank you, that's helpful. Are you able to tell me the substance of that agreement with those groups?
Yes, it's a bit of a process, but effectively, if I can give you a short version, it's driven from MFP. And MP and Kiwi, MP groups that we talked about, and just interacting with the Waikato Regional Council and Auckland Council, and alongside ourselves as Waikato Vegetable Growers Association. And that's come about because of the specified vegetable growing area that's been carved out by MP. That's a specified vegetable growing area. You probably know a little bit about that. And the water quality issues that are in that area. So we've been sort of given a temporary exemption to work on water quality because it's quite meant the baseline levels. So the groups come together and we're effectively working together to find out projects that we can try and enhance the water quality. On a sort of voluntary sort of basis. That's not really true. So there's projects
that are
funded. It's funded by MFP. And that funding comes in July 2025.
And the entities that you're speaking of here, like Tamaho, for example, you didn't the settlement entity there, or was it one of the Hapu?
No, it's just one of the iwi that come out and we're talking, speaking with them, and we're working through different. Possible projects that we can work on.
I understand that. That's a double hole is an iwi in itself.
Yes.
But it has a number of hapu.
I can't answer that.
You can't
answer that.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. And how often does this group meet?
So we've been meeting at least for the last 18 months, once a month, but in the last 6 months it's been probably every 2 weeks. We're getting close to making recommendations for the projects that we, as a group, would like to see funded by MFP.
Do you see it as being quite successful in terms of that makeup of that group?
Absolutely. I think it's been a really good a group to be part of, and it's actually got good relationships, especially from a growers' point of view, from PDGA's point of view, with the EU. And the commonality is that we actually have a quite interesting because they're very, very aligned in a lot of ways.
Right, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. McCann.
It's always good for the court to hear from people who are actually working on the ground and know their land and the people involved and what can or can't be done. And I'm interested in, because of your involvement in the wider sort of community, what's the level of awareness amongst most growers of PC1 and its possible implications for them?
As a general rule, most of the growers know about PC1, and they will have varying degrees of their knowledge. Obviously, a lot of our growers, we represent growers from as far as Walkwood through to the south of North of Calvert. So, a lot of them would be, there's no real need to know about PC1.
Yeah.
But obviously, there's the ones that are working in or have land in the PC1 area definitely well up to speed with what's going on.
Okay. Yes. Now, this is a question where you could lead me right up the garden path if you want to. But what I'm trying to find out is, what is the level of awareness of the importance of looking after the environment and doing the right thing in terms of practices in the industry? If you had a scale of 1 to 100, where do you think most people would be in terms of their journey along getting to good management practices and best management practices?
In terms of that, in terms of good management practices, I'd say that a good percentage of the growers would be at that level. A little bit variable. Obviously, the uptake of some of the practices have been really well received, and guys are definitely doing good with them. But also, too, via our good agricultural practice, like the New Zealand GAP programs, all the growers are on that sort of program, and so a lot of the environmental issues are covered in that. So you've got your practice in it to actually get your certification. So, and that's independently certified or audited. They're well on the journey, and we see it as being becoming more and more important as all these things are coming up in the different legislations that are coming through.
Okay, that's encouraging. And in terms of future improvements, you might have heard us talking about the fact that there's some quite large reductions that could be required to the catchment as a whole. Do you see much potential for more reductions in things like nitrogen and phosphorus sediment from CBT activities?
Difficult question. I think definitely like Mr. Barber mentioned earlier, like I think we will continue to see improvements. Really difficult to put any sort of numbers on that, but I know our practices are getting sharper. And you know, when we look at what we're doing, if you look at the cost of our inputs, like in terms of fertilizer, very, very expensive. So it's not something that we do lightly, just for the heck of it. So we are mindful of what we're doing, and we are looking to get a crop to finish, like that would have been earlier. So yeah, and I think there's definitely technology that will help us improve our fields, and as for us, we're more than willing to keep on that journey and continue to make change.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Mr. McCann, what's the class of the soils on your property?
All of our properties are in the Auckland region, but that one might say that all 1 and 2.
And my understanding is that those very high class of soils are quite valuable for production.
Correct.
I mean, to what extent is it important for you to conserve the soil just for the sake of your own production, your own well-being, the well-being of your business?
Oh, 100%. That's why we're implementing, we have cover crops that go in to increase our water for getting better when we have the ability to in between crops. Also, applying compost to fields that help build down again. So we are very aware that we're, like I mentioned before, the soil is our asset, so we have that at the top of mind when we're doing things to make sure that it is at peak and in good health.
Is runoff and erosion a risk factor for you?
It is, and we implement different things to try and manage that. But we find that the for Wilkesworth, so we'll actually must have planted, we'll go through and run a time through all the Wilkes, so it minimises the amount of water that's going to run off. So there are practices that are happening all the time to manage that.
Thank you very much. Anything arising? Thank you for everyone's time. We'll take a break now.